My name is Rachel Rofe. I created this show because I wanted to help you see that if you have a choice, you can choose a better life. If you're listening to this podcast, you're in a pretty fortunate position. You have free will, ability to connect to the internet, and access to all kinds of new education. This podcast is meant to help you make the most of your good fortune. We talk with all kinds of people here from all walks of life because I want you to see that no matter what your situation, there's always a way to create a life that you're proud of. Hello, everyone. Today we're here with Beth Burgess. Beth is a solution-focused therapist, coach, and writer specializing in addiction, anxiety disorders, stress, self-esteem, and mental well-being. She is the author of The Recovery Formula and The Happy Addict. I've actually never talked to Beth before. I found her because one day my assistant forwarded me an article of hers, and when I looked at it, I just immediately knew that she was going to be an incredible person to have to talk here just about getting over struggles. And I'll read you the first couple sentences that I read in her article just so you can see why I thought she'd be so great to be on the show. People who knew me 10 years ago would probably expect me to be dead now. They wouldn't expect me to have escaped my problems. They wouldn't expect me to have stopped drinking, drugging, taking overdoses, and cutting my arms. People who knew me 10 years ago saw a sacred shell of a girl, terrified on her own shadow and on a mission to self-destruct. They wouldn't expect me to have turned my life around completely. They certainly wouldn't expect me to be sharing my story and helping others to let go of their struggles, too. But then those people who knew me 10 years ago didn't know that I would find the secret to moving on from my struggles. I didn't know it back then, either. I thought that there was no hope for me and that I would never be over my woes. The secrets to moving on came to me slowly. It took years of suffering from anxiety and alcoholism before I found my solution, but it was worth the wait. Whatever your problems, and no matter how inescapable you think they are, the answers are always universal. So, as you can see why I would think she would be amazing to be on the show. So, Beth, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Rachel. It's great to be joining you. Thanks for asking me.
I'm so excited to talk to you and hear more about you. I always love to get this show started off by asking, you know, the intention behind A Better Life is to show people that if they have a choice, that they can choose a better life. So in that spirit, can you take a minute to share with us some of the things that you're the most proud of in your life right now?
It's easier to kind of list the things I didn't have to overcome than the things I did, to be honest. I've had a lot of struggles in my life, and that's included addiction, borderline personality, self-harm, social phobia, all sorts of things. And I think it's a culmination of having worked on myself and actually faced up to the truth of the matter in the end. Because I did struggle. I didn't do it first time round. I struggled for a long time before realizing what I had to do to get better. I'm just proud of having worked through it because it was hard. It took courage, you know, a lot, and learning to do things I'd never considered before. And it's just, yeah, it's wonderful that it's enabled me to, again, go on to help other people. So in a way, I think I'm most proud of using my experience to go on and help other people afterwards.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what does your life look like now?
It's wonderful. in fact, even if I have a bad day, I guess I can always look back at the days where I used to have and compare that and realize that I'm actually very, very lucky. I'm lucky enough to be able to, you know, I work with people on a one-to-one basis all the time. I write a lot, which is something I love doing as well. So I write articles about giving other people hope and inspiration. I get to talk to lovely people like you as well and share my message, which, you know, I couldn't ask for anything more, to be honest.
That's great. So I know you've worked really, really hard to get to where you are now. Can you describe a particularly notable time in your life? And I know you've dealt with a bunch of things, but a particularly notable time for you when you felt like things just weren't going the way you wanted, or maybe you felt trapped. And just tell us what was going on then, how you were feeling, and just paint us a picture because we want to be able to see the types of things that you've overcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, one of the hardest things was my social anxiety disorder, because I had that. From a very young age, I started sort of really developing the symptoms around the age of 14. And I didn't know what it was. And you don't at that age. It was things like I started being afraid of eating in front of people. I couldn't put my hand up in class. I just felt weird all the time. Like if I was walking outside somewhere, I felt like people were looking at me. It was difficult because at that age, I just assumed I was weird. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know that it even existed as a disorder. I'd never heard of it. It took absolutely years for us to even find out it was a real disorder. And the thing is, because it was anxiety, you find it so difficult to talk about it as well. Because every time I sort of tried to speak about it, it was like my mouth would just close up. There was just no way of getting out how I felt because it was so embarrassing. That was actually in many ways the toughest challenge. And I tried, we tried to get to the bottom of it, me and my family as well, who've been very supportive throughout, thank goodness. And I think that was one of the toughest things. And you just feel so stuck. And you think that that's going to be the rest of your life. You just think the rest of my life is just going to be like this, you know. And quite frankly, the way it felt, I was, you know, I tried to commit suicide about 7 times in total, I think. And, you know, even when I stopped doing that, because I realised it wasn't working, and it was just really upsetting, you know, my parents to have to come to the hospital every time I did that. But even when that happened, I was just hoping like a bus would run me over, do you know what I mean? Because it was, I felt like there was no way out of it at all. You know, I just couldn't see a way out. And then, of course, what I did to cope with the anxiety, because I had to still go outside and, you know, try and live my life, but I was so scared, I ended up drinking. And that, again, it just caused problems of its own. I ended up hating myself because, obviously, when you're drunk, you do certain things that you're not very proud of. It was just like a big mess, really. And I think that was the main thing. I could not see that it would ever change. And I'm so glad that I was wrong.
Wow. So that's a huge jump to be someone who at one point tried to commit suicide 7 times and was just hoping that something would happen where you die, to life being wonderful now. And I'm curious, what are some of the choices that you made? How did you decide to change your life around?
So one of the things was basically I realized that, you know, I could either just stay stuck where I was and just continue doing that until, you know, the inevitable happened, or I could try my very hardest to try and find some solutions for it. So although I didn't know what the answer was going to be, I was pretty determined to try everything that was going. And unfortunately, the process of doing that, I found a lot of things which didn't work. And a lot of the time, you know, you go for counselling or something, or you try a medication, and you just lose hope again because it's another thing that doesn't work. And you're just like, oh gosh, what, you know, is there any way out of this? But again, I'm very lucky that my family, you know, wouldn't let me give up, really. So it was a case of just continuing and just finding that courage to just carry on, even though life was awful at that time. It was just carrying on and believing that one day we'd find some kind of, you know, solution to it. And the thing is, this is what I believe of everything in life, basically. If you keep on going with it, it eventually comes to you. You just have to not give up. There's a solution for everything. And I think that's one of the biggest things I've learned coming through all of this. It's a solution for everything.
Was there something that happened? Were you just like, okay, I need to start looking for help? Or was it just kind of gradual?
And see, this is the thing. I'd basically, we'd very much been, because I found it difficult to talk about my anxiety disorder, we were very much focusing on the drinking. So my parents didn't even know really why I was drinking. They just thought I'd gone a bit, you know, crazy on it. They didn't really get the anxiety disorder. I did tell them that I had agoraphobia. I couldn't really talk about the other stuff because it was just too embarrassing to talk about. So we were looking for help constantly, you know, it was just with a slightly different focus. The idea was, I mean, we never really gave up. It was just a case of constant searching, do you know what I mean? And just trying to get through and make it through the difficult parts while we waited till something turned up which happened to help. And it was only almost, you know, by chance, my mum actually, who is one of these people, she thinks outside the box. She's a smart lady. And she suggested something to me that I'd never heard of before. I'd never heard of it. And we tried it and it worked. And it was like the best day of my life when I got rid of that anxiety disorder for good. And that was the point at which I could address all the other problems or start to. Because obviously it's not there wasn't one thing to sort out. There was a lot. But it was finding that solution for me, that one thing which worked, enabled me to believe then that there was other things that would work for the rest of it. And again, one by one, I started working on those things and finding the right answers. And there we go. And it's all kind of built up. You know, it's been a work in progress. And now I'm in a position that, you know, I'm able to help others with the same sort of things that helped me, which is wonderful.
What was it that you did that your mom suggested that worked?
I went to see an NLP practitioner. So it's something called neuro-linguistic programming, which it's linked with hypnotherapy. It's that type of thing, but it basically involves visualization. And there's something called a phobia cure, which I now sort of do with my clients. I do other things as well, because it depends. Everyone's a bit of an individual, so you have to see what works best with someone. But it's basically a very, very quick technique. I had one session with this practitioner, which took 90 minutes, and I walked out of there. I'd walked in, like, with my head down, shaking, walking down the street because I was so scared. And I walked out and I just skipped down the street with my head held high. It was amazing. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah.
It is amazing. I've heard of people, I mean, NLP, I've been to some NLP training and stuff, and I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
You can learn so much from it and just the way that you can rewire your brain. But I have not heard of anybody just going in for one session and having, especially considering everything that you had been dealing with, and then just being completely different. So you're saying like you went to one session and then you were good forever?
Yeah, basically with the anxiety disorder, yes. Like I said, the rest of it I had to do a lot more work on. So for example, the addiction itself, that takes a lot more work than one session. That's not something you can sort out with NLP. It's a very, very complex disorder. So as I've learned, so that took a lot more sort of work. But yes, one session, usually when I work with people, it's one session. Get rid of the anxiety disorder, it's just gone. Doesn't come back.
And so when you say anxiety disorder, do you mean, like I was talking to somebody last night about anxiety and she was saying it's a disorder, it can't really go away. Are you talking about that, like the full thing? Or are you talking about for people that maybe just have a little bit of anxiety or?
No, you can have a full on disorder. I had to have a drink to go outside. I couldn't go outside because I was so scared of going outside and being looked at. I had a serious anxiety disorder. It was only one session. The thing is, you have to just pinpoint, this is what I found when working with people, you have to pinpoint the one issue that's kind of caused it all. And it's usually something from childhood, and you have to go back and you have to work on that, allow them to reprocess that, and then it goes. It just goes. It's amazing. It's healing all that stuff, all that pain from childhood.
Wow. Yeah, that makes sense. So then when you were going over to dealing with your addiction, what were some of the things that you did to be able to work through that?
Okay, so addiction, and this is what I always tell people when I work with them. Firstly, learn about addiction, because addiction is one of those things that is completely, it seems like it defies logic if you don't have it. So if you don't have an addiction, watching someone who's got an addiction, you just think, why are you killing yourself? Why are you doing this? It's just, it's insane. But you have to learn about the way that the brain works if you want to overcome an addiction, because it will trick you. It tries to trick you into drinking. There's all sorts of weird mechanisms that go on when you have an addiction. And it's partly genetic. It's partly the way your brain works. So you really do have to understand addiction fully. And then you have to work on, again, healing up any of the past stuff that's kind of contributed to the issue. And then work on how you respond to life, basically. So you don't feel stressed out and think about reaching for a drink. You don't sort of, you know, carry around negative feelings. So you think about drinking and stuff like that. It's basically about working on the past, working on the present as well, just to build yourself, you know, into someone that can deal with the future.
So can you give me an example of how that worked for you?
Personally, I became a Buddhist. Because basically Buddhism is, I mean, you don't have to, it's not a religion if anyone's sort of turned off by that. It's basically a way of life. It's a way of causing yourself less suffering by the way that you think, the way that you act in the world. It's basically a way of freeing yourself from negative moods and, you know, negative thinking and always trying to crave things you don't have. It's just a way of being, really, which is really, really useful. So, I mean, the way I came across it was because I had borderline personality disorder. And one of the most effective treatments for that, which isn't available very much, unfortunately, so it's something I now teach, but it's called dialectical behaviour therapy. And people have probably heard of CBT, which is cognitive behaviour therapy, but DBT is a special one, which is sort of combined with elements of Buddhism. And it's used for people with personality disorders because it's very validating of how you feel. So with some people, CBT is a bit harsh. It kind of says, oh, stop thinking like that. That's bad. Think like this instead. Whereas CBT is more about learning to, you know, accept things you can't change, to change things you can, have the courage to do that. So it's a really good sort of thing. And I would say that's what got me my recovery from addiction, is learning to think and behave differently. And that was through DBT. And what I found the most useful parts of it were the Buddhist parts. So I basically looked into that a bit more and then went down that road. So, yeah, and it's been so helpful for me. Really helpful.
So when you say like the way of life, you've learned the way of life from them and different ways to approach things. Can you give us an example of, let's say your mind goes to, I really want to drink right now. What are the types of things that you would tell yourself with what you had been learning to help you change your mindset?
Okay, so the trick about really healing from this, I mean, in the early days of sort of recovery, you do get that sort of, oh gosh, I want to drink now sort of thing. The trick about it is that you learn to be a person that doesn't ever get to the stage where you're stressed enough to want that. So it's basically, so you think about things differently. So for example, most people get stressed out because they start worrying about what's happened in the past, or they start worrying about what's happening in the future. Now, you can never really be stressed about the present moment. You have a choice there of what action you can take to deal with how things are. So there's no point in worrying about the past or the future. You've only got the energy to deal with, you know, a certain amount of energy. So you may as well spend that on actually changing things in the present moment if you can. So basically, things like mindfulness meditation teach you to train your brain to come back to the present and focus on that rather than worrying about the past or the future. So it's just about becoming a more effective person that doesn't waste their energy on stressing out about things, worrying about things, thinking negative things about people. It teaches you things like, you know, not to be resentful against other people, because it's a waste of your energy. It's a drain that will make you feel bad. So it's training your mindset so that you're happier. That's what I think it is. And I'm more able to deal with life. And then you actually find you don't get those thoughts about, oh, I should have a drink, because you accept yourself as a person, you accept the world as it is, and you get on with it without ever getting to that stress threshold. Because a lot of the time, the things that make people relapse is high stress. And so if you can avoid that by changing your mindset, you don't get those niggling thoughts anymore.
So if someone were to come to you and they were a high-stress person, how much time would you tell them to spend removing the stress, doing the mindfulness meditations and doing things to calm themselves down?
I think it's really useful to include meditation as almost like something you do, like brushing your teeth. Because it's a way of maintaining your condition. So people, if they're in recovery, people have to work on the recovery all the time. You can't let it go, because actually you have a neural pathway in your brain now, which is addicted. And it will try and get you back down that path, because that's the way addiction works, basically. You've got this nice sort of strong response to most situations in life. You now think, oh, I should have a drink there, because if you've been drinking a long time, that's a normal response. So your brain starts giving you signals to do that. So to overcome it, you really have to keep a check on where you are, what your stress levels are like. So I always recommend to people, if they really want to sort of get into this, to do something like 5-10 minutes of mindfulness meditation every morning, where you kind of just focus on the body, how you're feeling, because a lot of the time we carry feelings in our body as well. Well, most of the time we do. So you can usually feel things like stress or anger, anxiety. You can feel that in your chest or in your stomach. You can feel tension maybe in your face, in your jaw, in your eyes, your shoulders. So it's about seeing where you are with the day. So I tell people when you wake up maybe to have a check of how you're doing today, and then another little mini check, you know, around lunchtime, another mini check in the evening. Because it's only by knowing how you are that you can learn how to respond to your day. So, for example, it's really important that if you know that you're feeling particularly stressed out about a certain issue, that you don't then take on something too challenging, do you know what I mean, on that particular day. You leave it for a bit. Or you go and do something else, or you do something else to help you feel better, whether it's going to help someone else, because that's always a great way of taking your mind off things, or doing a bit of exercise. You basically treat yourself in the day based on how you know you are, if you're mindful.
So what would you say to somebody who is maybe starting out and they're doing the mindfulness meditations and they're checking in the morning and at lunch and they're doing good, maybe they're doing it for a few days, and then all of a sudden something that super triggers them happens one night and they're kind of in the moment? Is there something that they can tell themselves or do in that moment, like their mind's too busy going to do the mindfulness meditation or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's definite things you can do in emergency situations. So one thing I always say is think about how what you do today will make you feel like tomorrow. Particularly with addicts, we're very bad at sort of predicting long-term things. We don't think about consequences. It's all about, oh, I have to change how I feel right now, yeah? So I always say to people, if you think about what you do today, basically builds your tomorrow, and then the next day, and the next day, and it's all a spiral. So if you do something negative today, it's going to take you down a negative route tomorrow as well, and the next day, and the next day, and you'll end up hating yourself for it, you know, and you'll just be going downwards. Instead, you can make a positive and powerful and courageous sometimes choice to do the next right thing. This is my mantra for life, do the next right thing. If you do the next right thing at all times, your life will be good.
I like that. I like that. One of the questions I was going to ask you is just one of the big thoughts that you have in your head, the decisions that you tell yourself about just being able to live the most empowered life possible. And I really like that, the one that you're saying now. I think that's really helpful, and it doesn't feel overwhelming at all.
I think that's because you're keeping it, you know, in the present moment, which is where it's the only place you can take action in. It's like, okay, if I just do the next right thing. You don't have to say to yourself, I'm going to be a saint for the rest of my life, you know? You just have to say, okay, I'm just going to do the next right thing. And when it's tough, when life's tough, sometimes you have to take things in these little bite-sized chunks, and it's easier to do that.
So you definitely, you worked with the NLP for the anxiety, and then you incorporated the Buddhist beliefs and the mindfulness meditations for getting over the addiction. Are there any other things that you did to help you get to where you are now, just like practices that people listening could take on?
I always think it's really important, just, I mean, general things, is to start doing something which means something to you as well. Really work on like having a life that means something to you. Because again, a lot of the times if we've gone down a path where we're feeling quite negative and maybe we've had things happen to us which are very painful and stuff, we just kind of shut down and we spend our life thinking that's just all there is. And actually, even when I was ill, I started doing something which I kind of knew was where my heart was. And I started working with the homeless as a volunteer, for example. But even when I was sick, I managed to do that just about. You know, as I went forward, I kind of knew that that was in my heart, that I wanted to help people. It was something that really was about me. Do you know what I mean? It sort of clicked with me. And so as I went forward, I didn't just start doing therapy with people as soon as I got better. I always wanted to be a journalist. So I went off and did that, and I did some journalism. And I found I missed helping people, you know. I found that there wasn't as much meaning to my life when I wasn't doing the things I was doing before with helping people out. And that's what I think really, again, sort of just consolidated my life for me, was doing something that actually means something really important to me. It's like a mission. So I think if you can find your mission, again, you've no reason really to not to be happy every day.
That's a great point. I'd love to dig into that for a minute. How do you suggest that people find things that are meaningful to them? Because I think that it's probably harder than it sounds for some people, huh?
Yeah, definitely. I get asked this question a lot. So I always tell people to look at what your values are. And if you don't know what they are, have a think about who you consider your hero. And it doesn't have to be anyone, you know, it might be someone famous, might be someone who lives next door to you, someone that you really, really admire. And then you can have a look at the things that it is that you admire about them. And funny enough, one of the people that when I did this exercise on myself that I really admired was one of my old counsellors. And I found that all the things that I loved about what he did were basically the same things that I wanted to do. And this is usually the case. The things that you admire in other people are the things that you want for yourself. So that's a really good starting point. Find out what your values are. Think about what really lights you up, what you have fun doing as well. Because again, like I've incorporated writing into what I do because I love writing. It's something I've always loved doing. When I was ill, I used to write, you know, depressing poetry, you know, and stuff like that. But I've always loved writing. So it was really important to me to be able to do things like write books now and write articles. So, yeah, again, just see what you enjoy doing as well and what you're good at as well. It's really good to sort of strengthen your skills and at things you're good at, because that makes you feel good about yourself too, boost your self-esteem.
Yeah. When you were thinking about your counselor and the different things that you liked about him, what were some of the qualities that you liked, and how could you have applied that into what's meaningful for you?
Obviously, one of the clearest things was helping other people. I liked that about him, which, you know, that I would then went on to do. I did like the fact that he seemed very peaceful. He was very kind of serene, and actually was a Buddhist. So I think that may have sort of, again, influenced my decision to go down that route. A lot of it was seeing what he was doing with other people. The way that I work with people, I think, is the way that he worked with me, actually, all those years ago. He very much worked with me as an individual, kind of respected who I was as well. I know some therapists and counsellors will just kind of just, okay, well, I'll do this technique with you, or I'll do that with you, and that will work. I think it's really important to work with people very empathetically, very kind of just getting who they are as an individual, and sort of working from there to see how you can help them best. And that's what he was like with me. He did things like he pushed the boundaries. I was only supposed to see him for a certain amount of time, because this was, we have the NHS in this country, so you get free treatment, but it's only limited. So you only get a certain amount of time with someone at a service. And he actually went out of his way to see me for longer because he thought I needed it. He wasn't even supposed to, he just did it. And when I moved out of the catchment area as well, you know, you're supposed to live in a certain area to do it, he still worked with me. And I think it's because he knew that there was a spark within me that wanted to get better. He believed in me. And again, that's something that I really value in. I think I hope I express all those same things that when I work with people.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of going about it. I really like, just for people who might not know what they value yet, or they might not know the things that light them up, just having those feelings that they want to go after and then being open to however they get expressed is really, really great. It's just a really good tool for people to kind of hang their head on.
Yeah, definitely.
And to switch gears for a second, I'm curious, as you were going and you were improving yourself and working on getting to the best version of yourself, how were the people around you getting impacted?
I mean, the thing is, when you start to do things which are the right things, some people won't like it. People who, for example, I used to know a lot of people who would drink a lot. And the way that they get away with it is by hiding the other people that drink a lot. So they felt very uncomfortable when I suddenly started getting better because I was the worst of a lot of them, you know? And it was like they were finally sort of forced to have a bit of a look at themselves. So there were some people that didn't like it. There were some people I had to not have in my life anymore because they were destructive people. But mostly, I mean, everyone's been very supportive, and this is what people don't realise. A lot of the time, when I work with clients, a lot of them complain about how their family are, or do you know what I mean? It's like, oh gosh, it's so hard for me to get sober because my family are very, you know, they don't trust me, they treat me like this. And I'm like, well, this is a result of they've been through with you, and you have to understand that. But as you start doing the right things and doing positive things, they'll suddenly get happier. They'll suddenly start to trust you more. It's like everything that you do with yourself, because you're a little part of the world, it all ripples out around you, all the good stuff you do, as good vibes rather than the negative vibes you were giving out before. From the way I talked to the person in the newsagents down the road, where I used to go in with, you know, my head down and like shaking and oh gosh, you know, now I smile and say hello. That's a nice way of affecting his day. Right down from the people I walk down the street and I can smile rather than walking past looking like freaked out. Right from those, you know, tiny people we encounter every day through to the people that I see every day, the people I love, you know, my family, my partner, my friends. It makes a difference to them all. If you can just focus on yourself and being the most positive and helpful and a good-hearted and genuine person that you can, everyone around you benefits, everyone.
It's been interesting because a lot of people that I've been talking to in podcasts, they talk a lot about how having support was able to help them. But what you're talking about, really pulling from your internal and really being very strong internally until kind of you're able to get people to rally around you too, huh?
Yeah, this is something I firmly believe. Everyone has to do it for themselves at the end of the day. It's very, very helpful to have people around you to do support. But if you don't have that, you can get better anyway. This is something I really want to, you know, get across to people, because people feel sometimes, because they've got a disorder or they've got an illness or they've got themselves into a bit of trouble, they kind of have no faith in themselves and they think, oh, well, that's it now, I can't do anything. They discount all the strengths they have, all the courage they have, all the wonderful lessons they've already learned, you know, they discount all of that. But actually, you can get better no matter what circumstance you're in. You don't need support. It's wonderful to have it. It's helpful to have it. If you don't have it, you can still get better. You've got all the resources within you to get better. And I know that because I managed to get through all these different things, and I'm not a special person. Do you know what I mean? I'm just someone that did it, and that everyone else can do it too. I know they can, because we all have it within us. We're all born with the resources we need. They just get pushed down a bit, buried, you know, a bit damaged and a bit scuffed up, but we still have them. And it's just a case of learning to access them again.
Absolutely. So when people are, they're just starting out, I know you say you have them check in morning, lunchtime, and again at night. Are there other action steps that you have them take to just constantly be in that place of empowerment?
Like I said, it's different for everyone you work with. But I mean, things that I generally recommend to people are things like practicing gratitude every day. So maybe before you go to bed, the last thing you do is write down 3 things or 5 things or 10 things that you're really grateful for, even if they're little things. Because, I mean, gratitude's been shown, you know, scientifically to actually make us happier. And to actually, it does, again, I think there's a study that showed that practicing gratitude every day actually does reduce relapsing onto things like alcohol and drugs. So it's a really, really good tool. So it's just little things like that, you know, waking up in the morning and maybe starting out with a positive thought or trying to start with a positive frame of mind. Addressing problems. If you have a problem, this is a really vital one. Don't ever just wait for it to, you know, to get out of control. Address it as soon as you can. Because I find the earlier you address problems, that the easier it is to address them, actually. And you don't have all that stress hanging over of not knowing what's happening and, oh, what do I do about this? And, oh, how's that going to turn out? If you just address it as soon as you can. So have the difficult conversation if you need to have it. Because it's actually easier to have that difficult conversation in the beginning than it is to wait for ages, wait a week, start really stressing yourself out and then have it. So as soon as you need to do something, do it. Get face up to the truth, get on with it as soon as you can. because that's actually the easier way.
In your experience, what's something that you feel like most people don't share about improving yourself? Just kind of like it's not sexy or it just doesn't paint that rainbows and butterflies picture. What's something that people really have to, like, it's maybe tough to deal with?
I mean, I guess a lot of the time, I would say everyone that I work with has had some kind of issues from childhood that they need to resolve. Now, they're not always something huge. I call it trauma with a big T and trauma with a little T. Okay, so there's trauma with a big T, which I'm sure you can imagine, violence, abuse, that sort of thing. But trauma with a little T is all those little kind of things that undermine us and make us feel like we're not worth anything, things like that. So it can be invalidated as a child, having gone through bullying, just those things growing up, maybe your parents got divorced, just those little things that give us these little triggers. So we have these internal triggers. So, for example, if your parents got divorced, you might find, I mean, my parents got divorced, and what I found was that I grew up with a real sense of abandonment in